I went and put all kinds of Listerine in my nose and everything else. Because I don't know from what it was. I wasn't cold outside at all, but I think I'm better now, and I think I'm all right now even. Oh, I don't think I've got a cough coming. Because I started to dose myself right away with all kinds of Listerine in my nose. So, you know, it was a kind of big building, the courthouse, with the window whistle there, and I had my hearing aid on. I heard the wind whistle this time for sure. And I sure heard the wind whistle, just like that around those curved corners, the courthouse. And I thought to myself, I'll never forget that corner right there when you went ahead, those three men left so at you because you went, you put your collar way up and they went like that. I see that because, you know, you went right ahead, oh, you had your collar way up. And I have seen the men, businessmen go and call themselves. And I thought to myself, I'll never forget it. My God, that corner right there by the old courthouse. Because I heard, and my skirt went just switch flash, you know. And I thought to myself, if Deborah would ever hear about that, the weather today, where we just got the weather for today, the coldest day of the year. And she's the thing I suppose outside the sunshine. I've seen something like that, the water to it this time of the year in the movies about a week ago. And splashing in the, right in the water. Because I never was cold this whole winter. This is the first time.
Oh,
yeah, that's the first time this winter, if you want to know more, that I was cold. Because I'll tell you how this wind, that wind went right through every finger in my glove. Just taking my kid gloves, and those gloves are always wet otherwise. You're always wet. Then I could feel the tips freeze right here, right inside those gloves. And that was when we got out first. Yeah, when we get out of the car, at first time when we get out of the car. Cold, it's because, you know, we lived right close to the Wisconsin River, about just about a block, and not quite a block ahead, that we were living right from the Wisconsin River, and they said that the breeze come right over across the river, so strong and cold. Then I had to go on that sawdust road where we were sitting by the monument, that's the sawdust road where I went home from the fly factory for 14 years. And for 14 winters, I went home on that road. Well, the fur on my neck would always have frost all over it. From the river, it's from the river, that's the dam ain't far from there.
Was that the fly factory?
Yes, from the fly factory.
How old were you when you worked there? How old?
See, I had to go to the courthouse for the permit. And because I wasn't of age. Yeah, I had to go for the permit to courthouse because I wasn't a beach, but the doctor, the courthouse thought, well, I guess your sister's to start to work because the Bernice looks pretty robust anyway. She looks pretty robust and strong, so I'll let her pass. She isn't a beach, but I'll let her pass. She looks healthy and strong enough to stand it, I guess. And my sister had to go the same way, without no education, too. I stood ahead of our education, just think we had a good right to work there and didn't know anything from being so busy, even how to cook or read or write or anything. And I didn't know how to read or write, I don't think, at that time, because I was home all the time with coughs and colds all winter long, besides.
Oh.
Yes, and she was too, my sister. Was home with the TB sometimes, so thin, you know, and tall with TB sometimes, early. And she'd stay home sometimes for 2 months with a great big cough on her just because she was a cough. She'd come home and stand by the stove and cough out her flagon. So my father wouldn't let her go. He said, you've got to be home. She wanted to go to work, but he wouldn't let her go no more. After she got the cough, she had to stay home for a while. But they wanted me to go to work even if I was coughing and coughing all night long. I couldn't sleep, but they wanted me to go to work. And when I went to work, well, they took the whole check from me, too, besides my parents. Took the whole check. I couldn't cash it. We had to work from 2. We had to work from 8 o'clock. We had to be there already. 8 o'clock until 12, and from 1 until 5.
Oh.
Yeah, so you see, so many hours we had to work besides every day for Sharon Cross. And so it was her, herself, Carrie Frost, that sent me home herself. If your parents don't keep you home, I'll have to send you home, she said to me. Because you don't look well and you can't be coughing around here because you don't look well and you're not well, she said. So she was the boss that she owned, but and her brother George didn't own the factory. She owned the factories herself. George was an old maid. Businesswoman, my God, she was a businesswoman, piercing dark black or brown eyes, I think. Black brown eyes. And honestly, she pierced those eyes at anybody. I hit my face already when I'd be coughing. You can't go downstairs to the office now. You have a coat now, she said. Yeah, put on your hat and coat. It's just you put it on right away and go right home. Because you don't look well. And don't come back until you're well, she says. She was about, let me see now. She was an old man too. She never got married. So she was about, my sister, she started to work too when she was 14. She had to get a permit like I did, you know. And she started to work when she was 14 years old. And she worked all the 30 those years to fly back to Myrtle. Because all those years, she never laid off either. She never got the vacations, or I didn't either. Because they don't give any vacations to the fly back to talk. And so you see, when she worked there for so many years, 30, then she got this touch of TB first. Then she stayed home from a Carisbrough Center home. She stayed home about 3 months. And then she wanted to go back herself so badly to work. But when she did go back to work, then she of course got the TB sooner again. Then when she got the TB, first and second touches in the lung of TB, then of course the doctor said that she shouldn't go back now and go to the factory. Well, she wanted to go so badly, yet, but we wouldn't let her go. Because now when we didn't let her go, then she just got the third stages and she soon died. We wanted to put her down to the hospital, the sanatorium, for better care. Friends all had the money turned out for all kinds of piles of money to get her to the sanatorium, you know. But she says, I'd rather stay right at home and die. She says, yeah. She'd cry every time we'd mention about the hospital. Oh. She'd cry. She didn't want to. She wanted to stay right home. She, looks so painful to me, you know, and she started to hold her side, right? You, it started to hurt her so. And then I think they said that blood was coming down with the symptoms, you know, that last. So they said call over Reverend Albert now for her last confession. So the Reverend Albert came to the confessional, and she got her communion. He says, yes, I don't think she lived very long. She could hardly whisper her confession. So she died the third day after her communion. She died right home. And sleep right in that whole bedroom myself because she had to have so much fresh air. So we had two beds there because I had to touch to be myself at that time when care brought them home. Mm-hmm. But the doctor come and examined me right away. It was 4 months later that my sister Johanna Sewing Club came over to our place there. And I was sitting behind the cooler wood stove. And three of them, girlfriends of my sister, come over to me and they says, Mrs. Barakatowski, my goodness, you're looking good and sad. They says to me, to Bernice, you know, to me. And so I opened my eyes so wide, you know, at those girls, and I thought, Mrs. Matikitowski, they called me. Yeah, Mrs. Matikitowski, they called me. And I said, I didn't know what to say. I kept looking at her. And so my mother came out of the bedroom. Here I am. She says, oh, for heaven's sake, we thought that this was Mrs. Matikitowski. Why, Bernice, what makes you comb your hair way up and wet and such a fog on top, like an old lady, they says. Yeah, and three double chins, oh my God, that can be Bernice, you. And how'd you get so fat? I don't know, the doctor told me to go to the box factory, and I start to eat just badly after I start to carry all those boxes and logs and everything. thing I had to carry. All the boys went down to the war. And we had to take the boys' place right by the sawmill woman. And I remember he took about 15 women right by the sawmill. I had to carry great big boxes and logs and everything to be sawed for my partner that was sawing. And I had to grab the boxes and logs and everything blocked. And I had to carry them on the elevator beside. Mm-hmm. Arm after arm, and I says, about 10 o'clock, I couldn't stand it. I started to eat like a man at last. And I started to eat like a man. When I come home for supper, I started to eat like a big man over and over because the work was so steady and pressure. They opened the window, the door, big doors in the home. Stream of the dam come right in there sometimes. And everything else inside the box. And I says, I got such a big lungs that I start to breathe and breathe so heavy, and the air come right down those tuberculosis lungs. And it come down so that I was breathing so heavy that I got certainly enough cold air from the river there. Yeah, and they says, but my heavens, you look like Terry Atkinson. Yeah. They says, you don't look good at all, even very, because you look like Terry Atkinson to me. I says, well, it's this old actor. I says, that's 300 pounds or what? Yes, you look something like him. Three big double chin. Well, we'd never tell you. Your mother didn't come out better, and we could never tell it to you. My brother Joe was about 2 years older than Jenna. And he got sick too. He got sick after he was about 2 years old, Johanna. And so she was 38, he was around 40. He never was married. He was a bachelor. And I had Paul for rescue there. Paul was fellow was the parlor. She went to the kitchen, got the broom, and chased him out.
Oh!
She got the broom and said, don't come here no more. Sit in my parlor, I'm sure. Don't come around our house here no more, she said. Or inside the house. Who let you inside the house, she says. Yeah. And I says, well, he knows me, and he come in for one, but he can't come in here no more. As quick as she got the broom, you know, like, because the father says that his whole family is nothing but little kitties. They're not, yeah, they're nothing but little kitties, and they can't, none of them get married. They're all my own little kitties. And they can't get married. They must all stay home all their life.
Oh.
Yeah. And the friends down the saloon asked them, Frank, how old are your kitties then? Well, the youngest one is 28. Oh, I thought you were talking about babies. I thought you were talking about babies, Frank. My God, if the youngest one is 20, but they're nothing but little kitties anyway, he says. And they had to be home all the life to Brother Gushka. Mm-hmm. And she says, why, Ben, that's foolish. That's foolish to stay single with the rest of the family, she says. Yes, and I love you and everything else, and you love me, so let's get married. That's how it happened that Ben got married. And So I never got married. I'm telling my father, I believe. I got my mother and the rest of me there. Henry never got married. He was a healthy boy, and I was healthy. And Joe was healthy before he went. All was healthy, too. 40-year-old man never got married, but he got so sick after 40 years old, he had to go down the hospital for treatment. He died now, so.
So it was Joe, Henry, John, or three boys then?
Yes.
Two girls.
Three boys and two girls. Take care of both. And an hour before he died, they put him right in my arms. On record shelf, they put him right on my arms. And I had to look at that big swollen red blue throat like this on my arm. I don't know what they did that for. I think I was about 13 years old. Or 13. No, 13 years old.
Oh, you might have gotten it.
Just like my father, too. And John looked just like my father, and he was dying right in my arms. Just about when he died, was just about dead, certainly. Then they took him off the arms and put him in bed, you know, because he was already dead. I don't know just what they did it, but I was pretty mad afterwards that they wanted me to see his death because I was so young and innocent, I did not understand nothing. I suppose that's why my aunt did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father was laid up. After John died, my father had great big pimples all over his face, measles. Then my brother got measles. Then my mother and I did, but the rest all had great big measles. It's strong looking, and I took care of the whole family myself, and I started to smoke those herb cigarettes by myself in the parlor. And it was pretty cool in the parlor. That's why I went and sat there on a rocking chair, and I started to smoke cigarettes after cigarettes, but I didn't want to show them or they'd think, what's the matter with her smoking cigarettes? But so I seen to it that they were not around me to see me since he was 14 years old. Yeah, since he was 14 years old, until the day he died, nearly. Because he went with his rheumatism in his legs on two crutches, and he walked down the sawdust road along the river there to the tailor shop. It's right down the Market Square, tailor shop there on the second floor. And Roger Glinsky had him employed from 14 years old until he was... 70, he was 71 when he died in St. Michael's Hospital. And he never did change his work. He was a tailor all his life. And he went through all his life to the tailor shop all those years since he was 14 years old. He went down to the tailor shop. And when he started to do the tailor shop work before he got married. He got married. He was about 15 and... she was around 14, very young.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. When they got married years ago, they could get married, so it's that young, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my father came right from Europe, the big ships there, and he was born on those big ships. He was born, the big ships of Europe, I remember that they said that they had those cows way down the lower berth of the ship, where that's how they got the milk, you know. For those that were born on the ship, and he came down to Stevens Point. And my mother was born in the Arnott, Wisconsin farm. That's about 80 miles outside of Stevens Point. And she said to me that she went out to Stevens Point with her parents down to see some relatives, and that's how my father met her. Real young, and then they got married real young. Remember when I was young?
Yeah, what's the first memory you have?
Oh, well, you mean when I was young, about 8 years old or so?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's like this. Then when I was about 8 years old, I remember my first Christmas present when my Aunt Helen came over from the farms. And she brought the Christmas presents, and I never did get many Christmas presents anyway, but my aunt was kind of wealthy. She brought over a great big doll, and aprons, pretty aprons and handkerchiefs and everything. And I'll never forget those great gifts of the dolls. They were so big and beautiful, the dolls. So I went and put the dolls on the lounge, on the sofa cushions in the lounge, in the parlor. Overnight once. So I went to bed, my sister as usual, and then I got up early in the morning to see my doll, and the wig was all off the doll and the eyes were out too. Yes. And I couldn't believe it, and I didn't see no eyes or no hair on her, and so I couldn't get over it, and who could have done that? Not my brothers, I surely thought that, you know. So it was nobody but the old Tom Ellicott did it.
Oh.
Just think that Tom Ellicott did it because my father says nobody else did it because we left them the house last night. And he must did it because I let him out at daybreak.
Yeah, he could.
When I went down to picnic down to the Wisconsin River there, and me and my brother started to jump over the logs in the water. And I rolled right in. I rolled right in the water, and the logs were all above my head besides.
Mm-hmm.
They were all above my head, those logs. And So it's like this, that my brother just had to support, and he held with both arms on the wall, but he was stronger, so he got right on top of the wall, and I grabbed hold of his ankles. Mm. I grabbed hold of his ankles just on time, because I was going down slowly, deeper and deeper. They were so surprised over it that I was so wet and everything else, so they laid me down on the ground and put some dry blankets around me and everything, because I was just a little girl, 7 years old. And they says, never again can you go down to the river, as long as you're living, they says, down to the river. But if I ever went down towards the river to pick these wild raspberries or anything like wild flowers, then they'd go right up to my mother and tell her that I ran off to the river again. So she'd run right up the whole block and a half right after me and get me right back to home. And I couldn't go to the river anymore. Not alone after that, unless they came, you know, and picked me. And never alone again. And I know that they took him very young for the first Holy Communion, because I was just about 9 years old, I think, when I went to First Holy Communion. But they said that if she goes down to the First Holy Communion now, then she could go right down to school back again after Communion. Yeah, she could go right to Communion and go right to school after Communion again and finish her education. The Catholic priest says, or to all of us there, and seems to me that I had some kind of a trouble, but I brought a nice veil and these wax wreath flowers that they were, and took it down to school, so everyone had one. It was my sister's. Yeah, it was my own sister. She went about 3 years quicker than I did, you know, down to Communion. And it was my own sister's, and it looked fresh and nice, and as could be, yet, so they let me wear Johanna's. And when I come over there, the sister Hilda says, I just can't find yours, she says, over at the shelf. Somebody must have stole it. Everyone was all dressed up, ready to go to church, and they all had their veil wreath. You can't receive this Holy Communion unless you have your veil wreath on, they said to me. So you've got to have one. So she went right to the sister's home, and she says, we've got some extra ones there, and I'll let you wear one of those, she says. So she brought it, but it wasn't so easy with my parents and neighbors, that they wanted to know where that disappeared, though, Johanna, so badly, because they wanted Johanna's veil and wreath so badly home back again, you know, that they wanted to keep it for some memories, you know. Mm-hmm. And they says that we must find out who could do it, you know. And I says, Mother, it might be probably that, you know, there was a neighbor girl that she didn't like me so much, as she made all kinds of trouble for me in school. That she used to steal my geography, and they used to steal my arithmetic many times. And the sister always was so kind that she gave me some of those books herself. Because I said, here was my books right here, and here was another little book. So they stole the geography and arithmetic, and the next day some other book was stolen. I says, and they says, how do you know? Well, I says, Elsa says, stay after school, both of you.
Stay after school?
Yes, but she says, stay after school, both of you, now. So, after the scholars went all home, then she calls up the desk and says, hold out your hand, she says, to me. And it was sort of a horsewhip.
Huh?
Yes, it was a horsewhip, and she gave me about one wipe right over the palm, and to Helen, too. Helen the same way. And then it was just about noon hour. We went home. And mine started to swell up so big with bubbles and blue that I couldn't go to school because my mother wouldn't let me go to school. After it swelled up so big and but all blue, big blue marks and bumbles over it besides, and blisters. So she said, you can't go to school in this condition. It's got to be sent up for something. Maybe the doctor has to come the way it looks. And to think that Helen's was the same way, blue like mine. Great big streak of blue and pull the blisters on top of it too. And after about the third day, the blisters started to crack, but the hand was all blue.
Oh.
So she whacked it pretty hard, Sister Hilda, Catholic sister. And so I says, my goodness, I says, I never think that those sisters use a horsewhip. I told it to Helen, you know, even if she got me in trouble many times. But I says, if they've got those horsewhips, I says, yes, they've got those horsewhips standing right under the desk, hidden there, all this. I said, that's the way the Catholic school is. Well, I said, the Fourth Ward school, certainly he doesn't have anything of the sort, the Fourth Ward school. So they went and says, what's the use of finishing this education down at the Catholic Polish school? But go right here in the same lot was the Fourth Ward school. The same block. The same block was the Fourth Ward school, our house and Mrs. Yass. Then the school was right in the same block. And they says that you've got it so much closer down to school. So finish your education down here to the Fourth Ward school.
There
was my sister Johanna, there was Ian, there was Joe, and there was Dan and Hendrik and John, see, to support. All of us had support just on the amount that he was making sold out to the tailor shop owner.
Yeah.
So you see what it was. There were so many of us, and we couldn't just about get around the grocery bill to pay or anything else. So Johanna started to work then. And she was glad to go, and so was I. I didn't care for an education that time, like I would now care about it. And
we don't call for it, and he said he'd put it in his room for a while.
Okay, well, good.
And then you can take John downtown tomorrow? No, not tomorrow, Saturday. Saturday. He goes to school tomorrow, isn't he?
Yeah. No, I don't think
My brothers and sisters had no education. Not one had education. Henry didn't either. And as far as Hannah had to work the same time I did. And Ben had less education and Joe had less than we did yet. Sure, so you see, there was another one that had any education at all. And Ben especially had to go down to the lumber company and work there too when he was quite young, he started about when he was 18. That's after our sister started to work, you know. Then he started about 18 years old. The lumber company was just a block from my home, so he didn't have to go very far. Those years ago, they had horses and dump carts to work for the lumber company. And we used to burn coal and wood those years. And I remember that wood was sawed right along the river in the winter and summer. And they always brought us such wet slabs from the river always, and my mother had to put arms full in the oven for to dry it up. That's why he used to work. Ben, he says that, I remember that he worked the summer, not the winter, just the summer down at the lumber company, but not the winter. He was working someplace else in the winter time. And my brother Joe was working down to the tailor shop, my father's tailor shop. Well, it was his first job and the last job too before he died, down to the tailor shop with my father. He used to go. And Henry used to work in the cradle factory, Bocoff's cradle factory. Well, he was there quite a few years, and I was 14 years in the fly factory. Henrik was quite a few years there, and Ben used to like to work outside the lumber. Well, I remember a week I didn't get much at first, because, they said, Jack Frost says that my flies were never hardly any good, so I don't know what it was, but the snails pulled out so much. My snails pulled out so much that they used to return the flies and snails back to me. and show me how they pulled out and that I didn't get nothing for it. See?
Oh.
I was the awful poor worker and my sister was a sampler, just think.
She was a what?
And the sampler. Sampler.
Oh.
Just think, the sampler, the best one for 300.
Oh.
Why, well, you see, the agents always used to call her down to the office and show some samples of hers, you see. And the agent used to buy them right off from her for a big price from my sister. Down there every month, Bertel.
Oh, every month?
Yes, and I just got about a month of about $23 or $24 a month. When the price pulled out, well, I used to get about 18 a month. And that's how I pulled out. But my sister got quite a big check. But you know what? She, of course, made the samples. But she didn't stretch out so many dozen, you know, either, because she made them just so. Well, she didn't get such a very big check. Maybe around 40 or 50 a month. The heckle is chicken feathers, bags full of chicken feathers, and ducks and geese feathers. Big bags. Well, you see, it makes a whole lot of dust. Now you see, now we put those hackles, twine them around the hook, and then we make a knot, you know. And we have to hold the thread in our mouth every minute or so. We got to hold the thread in our mouth in order to twine these hackles. And put the thread over and over in our mouth, you know. And the hackles have to be sterilized, of course, because we got to have the thread in our mouth all the time for each fry. Yes, we have got to put it in from the hands are dirty from heckles and everything else, you know, keep on putting the right between our teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why so many of those girls have consumption, because they have to boil out the heckle holder, the glass, the heckle holder, they have to boil it out good and everything else, and because the thread has to be in the mouth for every fly you make.
Exactly.
Sure. So, you know, I had to touch the bee, and the doctor forbid me to go over there. He says that I had to have pure air and everything without dust. And the windows way open, where we had to have the windows closed quite a bit on account of the way the breeze would blow the heckles right off our plates. See?
Oh.
Yes, the breeze, any little breeze would blow them all off on the floor for us. The doctor told me that I had to be more outside, more of a job outside, so I went. And it was during the First War that they didn't have enough men in the box factory, lumber box factory. They didn't have enough men, of course, now that they all had to go to the war, they were drafted. So they took women in the place of men, and I was one of them right behind the saw machine.
Oh.
A helper to the saw machine man. And I had to carry arms full of blocks, saw blocks up to the elevator and put it on the elevator where it went upstairs, where they made boxes. It was a box factory.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was right in the river, or nearly the box factory, and the air, plenty of air and breeze, all was with the doors wide open. Well, I was so fat and healthy that I liked to go out with the file uptown to show it, you know. And on my return home, well, there was a Polish fellow, Paul Pobreski, that used to live about 3 blocks from us there in the same direction. So he caught up to me and took me home. And it was kind of late in the afternoon, about 4 o'clock. So he come right in the house with me, sat in a pound on a rocking chair. And so my mother, I never thought my mother would be like this, but she come right in. She says, "How did you get in?" She says in Polish to him. "How did you get in? How did you get in? Just get out before I get the broom." She says that she went to the kitchen and says, "I'm getting the broom." And seems to me that she hit him on the elbow just as he flew out of the door. "Come back anymore here," she says. But it was that my father always used to say, "Those are all my little kitties and they can't leave home never." Yes, all my little kitties can never leave home. They have to be here until they die at home. Took us out there in the auto way down the route of town hall. And there was a big dance. Well, of course, I didn't know she'd stay that late. And the car broke down half the way, and so they had to stand an hour before they got help besides. And it was just daybreak when we come down to Stevens Point.
Oh.
Daybreak, of course. And my father had the habit of locking the house, all the doors, about 8 o'clock or so. 8 o'clock or so, all of a sudden, blow out the lamps too, you know. So then I didn't know what to do. I know I was out here in or something, so I went down to my grandmother, who was just a block away from us. So I went down to my grandmother. She was different. She let me in gladly. She put me right in the parlor bedroom besides, and the girlfriend too. Yeah, the girlfriend with me because she couldn't get in her home too, she thought, you know. So she come right with me. My grandmother was also good to both of us. And while the girlfriend went home in the morning, I stayed there about for a couple of days. She went right over to my house in the morning and told my mother that I was over there. And so she says, my mother was so mad that she says, I don't care if she never comes home, but just stays right over there to you, she said to my grandmother, forever, because I can't forgive her if we were so worried, and the father started to worry so too, you know, because that was my first night out, you know. So like, and she said that it was the girlfriend's fault, and her car broke down, all such fault, that's why we were so late. It called me something awful when I came home. And then it was like this, that I start to answer, and I says, my hands, I says, don't you see that the car was down? I'm not the one that wants to go. And my brother still a cup of water in my mouth when I start to talk. Yeah, a cup of water right in my mouth for answering my mother back like this. Mm-hmm. Yes, and what is it as well? Just quit talking. She quit talking too, and she told my brother to quit it, and I had to start to eat lunch right away when I come home there. And she said, don't let this thing happen again, because the doors will always be locked. Don't let this happen again, that you'll go out, she says, anymore. So one and I went to Chickacoop, and I sat down on a piece of a stump, and I started to watch. So one of my brothers had to go out to the privy because we hadn't had the waterworks in yet. That I went to the privy, and so when he went inside, I just fell right down because the door was not locked. And I ran up the pathway, got right in the house before he got out of there. And then I got in, and they thought it was him.
Oh.
They thought it was him, you know, and I sneaked right in bed, nobody knew it. I had really good times of parties up the place, there were nothing at all. Just the good times I had was when I went out with the girlfriends. And that was about the only good times I had, nothing else at all. Oh, men, sweethearts, or any engagements or anything like that, or any fellow couldn't come on a porch and ask me to go out neither, because my mother was right there first. And after she got rid of all of them with a broomstick, well, they never come back no more, none of them. But I remember that I went out to the girlfriend's secretly one night and sneaked in the same way from the chicken coop. They never knew it. But the fellow took his way across the river, Stevens Point River, and for God's sake, I was surprised to see that my married uncle was over there. Yeah, my married uncle's over there in the saloon drinking across the river. And so, you know, they started to dance. My uncle started to dance with a beautiful woman, and my girlfriend started to dance with young fellows there too. And so Stanley Kalki came up to me and he says, I used to go to school with you and I know you well. Come on, dance with me. Well, I says, if you learn me how, I said. And he said, oh, and my uncle come up and shook hands and says, no use to stand there, but learn how, I should think, to dance with me. And so I learned how to dance a two-step, I remember, and waltz.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah, a two-step waltz, and my uncle disappeared someplace and for a while, and I stood there alone afterwards watching, and then they all got ready to go home about midnight. They got ready to come home. And so Stanley Kalki took me about a block away from my home. And my girlfriend got out, and it was midnight, of course, about that time, and she says, I'll take her home, she says. And then the car whisked off, and I says, what are you fellows hustling so that you can't take me home? But you see, we've got to rush home, because we've got to be for the first mass tomorrow Sunday, and yeah, tomorrow Sunday, we've got to be for the first mass in the front seat where we belong. Or my parents will say something too, they says. Well, they went, and I thought to myself, I'll go down to mass. I'll be rubbing around the seat there, standing around the first seat. And so I went down further and back, almost the last seat I went, and I was watching. Sure enough, the fellows all came rushing in, and then about three or four at once came all rushing way into the front. Just to my mother, how come that she's living over there? She's married and she's got a little baby there. And she's really that front apartment there. But she doesn't talk to us or nothing, to nobody. And I don't think she'd know you after these years either, so don't go over there. She had a little baby, but I knew I could tell her it was her. Mm-hmm. They married at all, like she did. So crazy about the fellas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was awfully crazy about the fellas, and I remember that she would always say that she's going out loving. That I'm going out loving now, the sweetheart. She said profile to me. That she was kind of compassionate and everything else, because as she come over down to my place one rainy afternoon, it was raining pitchforks I cut outside, and I was sewing on my father's sewing machine at home, some dresses, and I thought it rained so hard. She come over, she says, I just got to go over. I just got to go out for me today. I got to go out to tell us today. Well, I said, I can't go. My parents won't let me go in the rain like this, I said. And she started to tease me. Well, at length she went out herself, because my mother started to get to know Bernice can't go out today. It's raining too hard. It's raining too hard. She's getting a sore dress today. So she went out then herself, I remember, because she says, I just got to go out tonight. I just feel like going out today, she says. And get over town, she did come right to our house and sprawl right on the floor in front of me. Yeah, compassionate as could be, I thought she was. See to it that she don't act like that anymore when she comes here. See to it that she don't act like that, for God's sake, when she comes over here. Laying on the floor, what if actually somebody would step in right then? And see her laying like that. Was she sleeping or something? I don't know. She had a lot of children herself and everything else. But still, we couldn't go out. Either it was my father or my mother, I don't know who it was, that we couldn't go out. Well, it seems funny, Myrtle, that we shouldn't have got married.
No.
You know what Dr. Friedman says? He says that I'd be the very finest, healthiest mother on earth. He says, if I had about eight children born, he says. Yes, he says about eight children born.
You love children.
Dr. Friedman was superintendent at the hospital, superintendent.
Uh-huh.
And he says that I'd be the very healthiest and the very healthiest children, he says. If I had about eight children born, he says, that they'd be such a beautiful, healthy children, he said.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
He told that he's a doctor. I left Stevens Point the first time. That was with my sister-in-law, and I was just about 28 years old.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I remember I was 28. I remember that surely, yes, especially. But when I came home, then I left Stevens Point when I was about 35, the second time. Oh, yeah. Her apartment to make bowl in Stevens Point, make bowl Avenue. That's on East 7th Street, and she took me right down to the apartment for the first job.
Oh.
Because I had to leave home, because the doctor says that she isn't well at all, and she's got some sort of baby, you know.
You cried?
Well, because he didn't want me to leave home yet. Not even better. Well, you know, I did go right to her front and ask you just me this year, John. Now, to Dr. Winning's place is the first one house in front of the newspaper. She called over the phone, and she says, all right, I'll bring you right over this afternoon, and you can talk to her. So she brought me over to Dr. Winning's place, steady housework. And she says, but she don't know how to cook, or she doesn't know very much housework. I'll teach her. I'll even teach her, but I'll give her only half the salary at first while I'm teaching her. She says, half the salary. That would be about $45 a month anyway. My sister-in-law said it was good, $45 a month, room and board. And She says, of course, I was giving the other ones around 80 or so, you know. Well, I am awfully glad that you'd be willing to teach her, at least, she says. And, yes, I'll teach her and everything. And so I remember when I started to work for her, well, she got up at the same time I did. She told me how to raise the curtains at first all evening, you know. And then she showed me how to measure the coffee, poach the eggs, put out the juice, and how many minutes the egg should be poached and the coffee should be boiled, all that. Well, I went right out to the Dusty Winnick's table and set the table for him and brought in the eggs and all that. But he didn't like it very well, so he says, you better bring in the meal and let her cook it in the kitchen. And you better catch these modules to it, yet. Anything like that till after. They weren't home, and I went down to her friend next door. And it seems to me she was some kind of Mrs. Smith, next door, some friend of hers. And I heard the dogs barking. She had a sort of a roof there built for the dogs. I heard the dogs barking, but I couldn't get her either, Mrs. Smith there. So I started to sit over on the steps to Perkutowski's house, and then they both come from work, remember. And she says, I can't understand why you didn't stay there longer. Well, I don't know what it is, but they just thought that I knew everything now and that I would like to come home for a while. So, keep on with this.
Huh?
You want to ask me a different question now?
No, go right ahead.
Keep on with this here.
Uh-huh.
Well, after I, yeah, we used to lay around here, but if Ben says if you want to stay here a week and go uptown and find the streets better, it would be all right. But here's a job that pays awfully good wages and tips of producing Paul Odell in the basement of the dishwasher. Well, my brother says, oh, for heaven's sake, let us stay home for a week or 2 years. Well, when I started to work down, well, I remember that it was that I got out of there about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was sort of a night job. 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just didn't want to stand away the whole hour for the streetcar bus. So when I was halfway to home, well, there was some kind of young fella that started to chase me. And as I started to run faster, he started to run faster. And when I ran faster and faster and faster, he ran faster too. And I just got inside the door when he come right by the door and tried to shove it open. But I just about got the catch lockdown time. And I could hardly walk up the steps, and I was so tired out, you know. And she says, if that happened by death, Bernice, why didn't you wake us up and ask again? We'd call the police. And they start to quarrel again. I didn't hear nothing but quarreling again. Because I can't understand, Ben, why you stick up where she was supposed to call the police or something. On the telephone here, she says, I see you take the pie, and I seen you take drinks and everything from the colors there. How long will you keep a job doing such a thing like that, she says. Me and Ben was watching you right there, and you better go home or something. If we, you better go home or something if we've got to be watching all the time, she says. Yeah, and she says, that Ben won't take this job for you here then, no more. Go out quite a bit to the shows and had my own friends now at last. Mm-hmm. All the friends I wanted to go out with, I had so many friends I couldn't count them. After I started to go around counting your friends too. German and Swedish and Irish and Polish, all kinds of good friends I had. Besides, fellows of all kinds come over after me and I couldn't even have time to eat the food garbage. Because they come after me at all hours of the night and day to go out to the shows. And then I certainly had plenty of company, but I remember she met me once uptown, my sister-in-law. She says, come over, she says, to the apartment once. And you know, my mother used to write to me, Myrtle, and then she used to always say, come now again, this year again, now when the garden is the best now. The garden has got, the weather was so nice, raining so much this year, that we got so much beans and so much peas now, and we got so much cucumbers, And we'd like to have you down now while the garden is the best now. Mm-hmm. Everything is so fresh and so much now this year from lots of rain.
She wanted you home, huh?
Or since Mitchie was on some kind of a pension, I think. And some kind of a neighbor sent over a sheriff right to our place, a neighbor, and said that I and my brother was living on the mother's pension too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the sheriff, my God, I said, you've got nerve to come over here, I says, right out to the sheriff. You've got lots of nerve to come right over here over such a complaint like that, I says. We were living out of the garden and everything else, and So my brother said, shut up to me, don't say nothing to me. And started to cry over in the depot before the train. And then I started to cry just awful hard when that train was rushing in, you know. And I didn't want to get leave home or something because, you know, because of the bad luck that it happened so thoroughly from the neighbors, you know. And then, well, it was one neighbor that did it next door there. And I said, I never thought anything like that in my life. I said, that there are such a people like that, I said, as long as I'm living, I said. And I didn't know who they were or anything else either. And so if that's it, I said, that this company like that. So I started to cry harder and harder. And at last the train come in and I wiped my eyes and powered myself up in the ladies' restroom. So I rushed in and the train at last, after the train started to go, I felt a little better now. And I came right down to my sister-in-law's house. They took me down, gave me a big celebration, a great big supper, and took me down to show both of them.
Uh-huh.
Home, I remember.
Oh.
Yeah, my father died during the time I went down to.
Oh, he went on to his funeral, huh?
You, Grant Hess, you know. Grant Hess had me out in North St. Paul colleges for rent there, you know. And so I left for Stevens Point from this carriage.
Oh.
That was long after I met you here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, after I met you. Surely, you know, your letters came right down to Stevens Point there, your letters came. My brother and mother used to read your letters and they'd start to laugh almost.
Huh?
I don't know why, but they all start to laugh. They were either glad that I had a friend or something. How old I was when I come down first to your place or not.
Well,
it seems to me that I felt awfully young, and it seemed to me I looked awfully young too, then I was my age, because I felt awfully young at 35 years old. Well, I remember that I came down to right at the same point of view, that was right when I didn't have a job or anything else, money either, then I went right down to the basement YWCA for a job, I remember. And there was an old woman come ahead of me for a job to this. And I heard her say like this to her, what's the matter? Oh, do you think that you'll be coming up here, Mrs. Teddy, Mrs. here, for a job? They don't want you. Look at the kind of a shoes you got on. I heard her say that right to this woman ahead of me.
Huh?
So I took a look at the shoes to see what was wrong. And they were bedroom slippers.
Oh!
Yeah, felt bedroom slippers. And she walked out with her when I seen felt bedroom slippers, you know. Yeah, so she said, don't come around here with shoes out like that for a job anymore. So then I sat down at this, and she says, well, I have a very nice job today, she says. And so nearby that you can find it right away too, she says, besides to me. She says, do you know Myrtle LaSueur? No. Well, Myrtle LaSueur and her two children are just go straight to this corner and then go one block down. You're there. And be sure you go there because she wants somebody right away now. And I think that you'll get a nice job over there, she says, too, to me. So, when I come down there, of course, it seems to me that Bob was there. Was it Bob or the other, that one, the first husband that you had?
I don't know.
Well, I think it was Bob there, and I come over there, and there was nobody home, of course, just he says that these are my two children. Myrtle is gone. I don't know just when she'll return, but you better stay right here, and I think she'd be glad to take you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I sure will, I said. So I had a bedroom right there, and the children had a bedroom right next to me. And when you come in that night, I remember that I was sound asleep and the children were too. I started to take care of them, Brandy, so that your husband could go out of town. And you came in and says, you're over. And after you started talking over, you said that you'd like to hire me right away there, that you'd give me so much a week there for taking care of Deborah and Rachel. If I took them out for fresh air, they'd come to Harriet Parks or across the bridges here where they could get the air and sunshine and scenery. Well, I started to take care of them and bathe them, and you got home after your reporter jobs. And so after I took them down to the Harriet Island Park there, and see the animals, lions and tigers and squirrels and everything in cages, they had those here. And the children would like to sit right on the bench with me there and just swing or either on the bench with me. But the wind was in March, right apart of March, the wind started to get so strong sometimes, you know, they had fur coats on. The wind started to get strong, you know, just along the river bank there. So I seen that little Deborah was still looking cold, so I says, we better go, I says. Anyway, the animals never get cold, they cage, but us do, I says. So I said, let's get going, and when we jump down to the bridge, Robert Street Bridge, and everybody that passed us says, oh my, what beautiful little girls, they says. Yeah, could we look at those girls? Could we pick them up and look at them? I says, well, I don't think that you should pick them up, I says. But I says, you still look at them? I says, that they're so beautiful. I says, but we know that you're not the mother. Because we know that you're not the mother, that you're the maid, we can tell right away. Because you're so light complexion. Right here, you know that you're in the mother. Ain't they beautiful, sweet little things, they say to me. And I just passed it right by and passed more and more, but they all looked at the children and smiled, so because they were such beautiful little girls with such a natural curly brown hair and such a nice big brown eyes they had, just like little dolls, couple of little dolls.
Did they quarrel?
Oh, if they quarrel, well, they were sort of a dreamy little children, like as if they were always daydreaming or something. They were so quiet. They'd be daydreaming when I'd look in their eyes. They had their eyes half closed, like they'd be daydreaming when I looked their eyes and asked them if they were cold or hungry and things. Well, they just stood like dolls. They didn't move their lips or nothing. But once in a while, they'd say yes or no, but not very often. But, yes, they shake their head, go down the winter time, down the snow with the sleds and snowball a whole lot. They used to like that. But they liked this better than anything else. When I stood on the Rubber Street Third Avenue Bridge, why, they liked this the best, to see all the trains go beneath the bridge. They liked to see them go back and forth, all kinds of big train stations to me. And just look at the smoke and look at the big train, they said to me all the time. And so I stood there with them as long as they wanted to. But I thought to myself, when you ever children make a move on, I can see that you are wet and everything else, and still you don't want us to move home or what's wrong. Oh no, look at the big trains, the trains. And I says, well, we've got to go home now. I've got to change us and take us home now and give you some bath and give you supper to you now. I says, we just want to sit right on the fender. Yes, a long time on the fender if we get tired. Sit there and look at the trees. Yes. Like that better than old. They like. And start to go right down to the porch. Fireplace porch. And she stood right on the porch.
The fire escape.
Moonlight. Great big moonlight come out. And she was looking right straight down the moon there. For about an hour, and I thought to myself, my goodness, do you like the moon so badly, Deborah? I says, and yes, I said, so badly, don't you know that you're here an hour, and Rachel is sound asleep already. And she says, Well, don't take me in yet, she says. And I says, what could it be? Are you lonesome or something for your mother? I says, because Rachel is sleeping. I'd like to put you to bed, Deborah. And she was standing so quiet and emotionally and all, so nice and quiet and looking at the sky and the moon. Might be was so beautiful to her, the moon and the sky, the big city there. St. Paul Public below, she's seen all those lights from the city or something there. And it was a third floor apartment, yes. Such a sort of a little back porch you have there. And she was standing right against the railing there. Well, I had to stand right with her there because so in the accident wouldn't happen. Then at last, at last I said, now we'll go in, Deborah. I said, at last, you've seen the moon over. No, I'll bring you out just some other time, I said, on the porch. Well, she come in just as nice right ahead of me, and she got right in, and I put her in the crib. She laid right down by herself, so nice, and fell asleep right away, too, besides. Then I was glad I let her see the moon if she wanted to see it, so that made the stars. Because she slept real good, sound asleep after I put her to the bed there, and Rachel was sleepy. Such a quiet children, almost sort of a dreamy, like daydreaming in their eyes, almost like daydreaming, so quiet, thinking deeply all the time. And like the other children were almost such a screaming talky children, what I used to take care of other ones. Screaming all day long and talking. But not that for Rachel. They were the quietest children I ever knew of when they were little children. Beautiful as to be. I never seen anything as to beautiful children like those. I remember when I met the sort of rock cellar where I was sleeping in the first floor. If it was on St. Peter's, you heard they were Rachel, and you had a private little home there, just below the Salt Lake Tunnel, wasn't it? Yeah, below the Salt Lake Tunnel, where you had a little white house there, rented privately there. And I remember that I used to do the baking, cooking, and everything else for Rachel and Deborah, and they were quite big girls now. They were playing around the neighborhood, the big backyard all the time, and there was the Italian... You remember? That's quite a few months right there. I took care of both of them. But as it was, I was real young and foolish those years, because I came right up to you and I says, Myrtle, that I get over $300 saved now, and that's what I was working for this money. I want to have a change so badly, I says, that I don't know what it is, and I want to have a change so badly and go out on the farm, I said, for a while. And you didn't like it very well, because the children liked me so, and they were growing up so nice now, and I could go out the way uptown with them now and all over. And still, I says that I'd like to go out the farm, and I went back for North St. Yes, it was... towards White Bear, between White Bear and North St. Paul it was, between White Bear and North St. Paul, where I got this farm, and Mr. Seaman was the owner of the shack, and he says that if you want to raise any chickens here, then raise it. He says all you want to take care of the whole farm.
How'd you find him?
Well, I got myself 300 Plymouth Rock, 300.
Oh.
And he thought that was quite a number to take care of without any disease or anything. But, you know, as it is, that Mr. Seaman was the fireman at the Zinsmaker brass company. Fireman there, Zinsmaker brass company. And he got such a very big wages there. And every time he come home from work, he brought... great big bag of lopsided donuts and a great big bag of lopsided coffee cakes and also biscuits, cakes and cherry cakes and buns and donuts of all kinds and breads of all kinds. He brought about six big bags, and I said, how do you get this? Because they can't sell it when they're lopsided. Some of those girls are learning, you know, and so they eat even. So, you know, he gives it to me all I want for my pigs. And I said, how many pigs have you got? I've got about 13. I've got to feed the pigs and take some bags to feed your chickens with. All you want, he said, to feed your chickens with. I had 300 pounds of dark rocks. He had 13 pigs to feed there. So I said, I'll feed your pigs for you, and also this here. And he went down to work nights. He had to work there all night, of course. So I was afraid to sleep there nights all alone on his farm, so I went down to...
Thank you for this beer, a little wine and water mix. Then you shot a whiskey, I drank it as if it was water. And I said, well, what about the other one? I don't know if somebody wants another one.